Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're streaming live at kuci.org. Today's interview was recorded on Friday, February 5th, 2021. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'm here today with Catherine Seligman. Catherine is a journalist and author in San Francisco. She's been a staff writer at the San Francisco Chronicle magazine and a reporter for the San Francisco Examiner and USA Today. Her stories have appeared in Redbook, Life, Time, California Magazine, PBS Next Avenue, Cal Matters, Al Jazeera, America, and the anthology Fresh Takes. She's a member of the San Francisco Writers Grotto and loves working in clay. She's here to talk about her new novel, At the Edge of the Hate, published by Algonquin and winner of the Penn Bellwether Prize for socially engaged fiction. Scott Turow says of the book, a terrific novel, half murder mystery, half a tale of growing up. The heroine and her friends are unique in my reading experience. Homeless young people living in Golden Gate Park with their own community and their own rules. And their story is suspenseful and touching throughout. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, the book came in, an advanced reader's copy came in, and what I do with books that come in is I just start with the first page, and I found myself just drawn in right from the start. That first chapter was really compelling, and I'm so curious what the inspiration for the book was, how it came about.
Well, I have lived and written from San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury for more than 20 years and have seen a whole range of young people and drifters and seekers who've filtered through this neighborhood. And ever since the Summer of Love and the sort of hippie movement got started here, which was before I lived here, but these kids keep coming through. And it was an environment I got to know better and better as I talked to the kids. And I felt like I sort of understood a lot of them until one night when my husband and I were driving home through Golden Gate Park and some guy jumped in front of our car and said, "You have to stop. Someone's trying to kill me." We called the police. They shone a light into this grass area near the car. And there was this kid lying there and he was taking what was his last breath. So there was virtually no investigation of it because there'd been no witnesses. So the killer was let go. And I just kept wondering, who was this kid who died and who is this kid, this man who had killed him, and why did their lives cross that way? And what was I missing as I walked down the street and maybe even through my own house and hallways of offices about stories that were unseen?
So then how much later was it that you started writing the book, or that you even thought there was a book there?
Well, I initially thought I might write something as a journalist, and I did a lot of research. I looked up as many court records as I could and talked to the police and started talking to kids. And then I realized what I really wanted to write about was that sense of living in such close proximity to people and having no idea about their story and the secrets that people that I pass every day were holding. And I thought that fiction was a better way of getting at that than would a nonfiction book be.
Yeah. It's funny, I left San Francisco around 1986, and I spent a lot of time before that point on Haight Street. I worked at a restaurant on Haight Street. I used to go to, there was a store called Just Desserts that had pastries and coffee. I spent a lot of time there, and it wasn't anything like this yet, It was really interesting to revisit the area through your book. And I remember, Golden Gate Park, it was full of drummers and You know, I don't recall anybody living there then. So it's interesting how much it's changed, as has many cities, right, in the last however many years.
Definitely. Yeah, I came to live in this neighborhood in the late, like 1989. So it had already really started to change as the city got more unaffordable. Mm-hmm. And the kids kept streaming through. And so I think, you know, there were more and more people pushed out of housing, adding to what, you know, what you see here is a very visible situation.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed the mystery aspect of the novel. There were a few threads going through the book. And so, you know, as I was reading, I was wondering how you as a writer kind of kept track of the threads. You know, there is the murder that we find out about in the first chapter, but then, you know, the kid's parents come to town. Maddie, your main character, is dealing with her own thing. And then the side characters, Hope, Fleet, and Ash, are dealing with their lives, and Maddie's involved with those. How did you develop the various threads and then keep track of them?
Well, you know, it was, I played early on with the notion of telling the story from different points of view and actually writing a lot of the book from different points of view. And then And that in the end actually helped me keep track of some of the plot lines that had to do with other characters and to understand them better. I think sometimes it helps to try to write in the, whether you're writing in a first person or a third person, to try to write in the voice of that character, even if that's not what you're doing in your book, because it really helps you step into that frame of mind and into that voice. So that's partly how I did it. And just trying to keep track of, you know, of what was going on. I didn't, like, you know, unlike a lot of novelists, I've been talking to more and more people who actually use software to help them keep track of things like that. I did not do that, although I may look into that at some point in the future, but I think a lot of people are doing that. I used old fashioned pen, paper, notes on the wall.
So then you decided to just keep it in Maddie's point of view.
Yes. After trying to, when I experimented with using other points of view, I again found that it wasn't what I wanted to write about. And so all along the way, there were all these choices to make, which is, of course, another thing that surprised me, the number of choices that I was making with every single thing I did. So, which is sort of a different aspect than I'd experienced in as a journalist. Well, I was going to say where real events really dictate what you can say. You still may be looking for the story behind the story, which is why anyone would care to read, you know, a narrative version of something that had happened. But in a novel, it's sort of a different sense of where you're taking the story, because that's how you, where you feel it should go.
Yeah. I think it's a great exercise to write from different points of view to really get at the story and get at the characters. When I suggest this, sometimes when I suggest this to my students, and say, you know, you might not even use it. You might just, you know, play around and check out these other characters. And they look at me like, what, I'm going to do all that writing and I'm not going to use it?
Yeah, I did a fair amount of that writing and not using it. And I actually did think it was extremely useful. I like that you ask people to do that, because I do think it can be very useful to get really into the head of a character, even if you're not going to write from that character's point of view. So I did, there were a couple of the kids where I sat down and I wrote their journal entries, what I thought their journal entries might be if they wrote in a journal. just to try to really get into their heads.
Was there a character you especially related to?
I really related to to Maddie. And I also really related to the parents, because I do have kids who are now in their 20s and who we grew up in this neighborhood. And I just kept thinking, what if that was one of my kids that had ended up there, that had ended up in the park, that had left home, that it just this sense of you don't know, and you don't know what your children are really thinking. And I remember in high school, one of the counselors talking to us and saying, you know, don't make the mistake of thinking that there are good kids and bad kids. All the kids they're all good. But they're going to try things. They're going to do things. They're going to surprise you. You might not know what they're thinking. And I really thought that that's true. That really made an impression on me as I was writing the novel.
I'd love to hear you read from At the Edge of the Hate. Did you do that?
I will. And actually, this follows sort of what we've been talking about, because I want to read a portion that has to do with what the parents went through. I'm looking for the section.
If you just right tuned here. In, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Catherine Seligman. Is that how you pronounce your last name?
Yes, it's Seligman.
Okay. Good. And she's about to read from At the Edge of the Hate, published by Algonquin. Okay,
here we go. She must have said she was Shane's mother, or the officer wouldn't have told her anything. I have some bad news, he'd said. Shane had been, and she lowered her voice so I could hardly hear what she said, the victim of a homicide. She said she'd started screaming at him. Why are you telling me this? She didn't get it. Who would call and say something like that? She didn't remember her neighbor coming over, but she must have been there, Marva said, because she found herself wrapped in a blanket sitting on the couch when Dave came home. He'd handled the details, calm and ordered, in the way that he always was. It was what made him so good in the fire department, where everyone looked up to him. Stay focused, he always told them. Respond, assess, and then go forward. Don't rush in with that information. He was the one who'd arranged for them to get to San Francisco. The worst thing was that I never knew where Shane slept, Marva said. You want to know that, where they put their head down at night. Then when I went to bed, I could have pictured that. It would have helped. I should have been there with him. I thought I'd go later, but I didn't. You always think you have time. She was the one who'd wanted to rearrange furniture and get new rugs every spring to cook new dishes from recipes she found in the magazines. But ever since Shane had left, she'd kept his room like he'd left it. In the pictures on the wall, mostly cartoons he'd sketched of tiny armies of men facing off, a stockpile of catapults and bows and arrows behind them. She'd wished she'd asked him more questions when he was there, because when she started examining the miniature cartoon faces after he left, she could tell each one was different. From a distance, they looked the same. Maybe he was telling a story and not just doodling. The last time he'd called, he almost sounded like he missed her, but maybe she'd just imagined that. Where are you staying? She asked. He didn't answer. She'd offered to wire him money and was half glad when he refused, because Dave had said that that only enabled him and she should let him go and find his own path, as if she had any choice. He'd gotten off the phone so quickly and he'd said, "Bye, Ma. Some guys and I, we're going for some food." "The guys?" she said, turning to me again. "Do you know them? Who is he talking about?" But she didn't wait for me to answer. "We should have moved out here," she said to Dave, who was sitting in the driver's seat. Root had made it over next to him. "There would have been more for him to do here in a city. We could have lived out here." Her voice got louder. Dave reached over Root and put an arm around her. She slid away and turned completely around in her seat. "Ma," she said, looking at me, just like when he was little, he called me Ma. So that's it.
Thank you
so
much.
From a mother's point of view, you know, about how she felt having him disappear and hearing what had happened.
In reading, you reminded me of Root, Maddie's dog. I love Root. Talk about Root and him finding his way into the book.
Well, I think of Root as a real character in the book. Mm-hmm. And she finds him and sort of liberates him. It feels that she takes him and she's helping him out. And that starts a relationship that she's really able to be sort of more vulnerable and show her feelings more with Root, because he can't betray her. He's a dog. He does disappear at one point, but there's a certain safety in being emotional with him and having him there through everything. And of course, it is something that really happens, that kids more and more, just so many of them seem to have dogs who they genuinely adore and care for pretty well. Sometimes you see dogs in distress, but usually you see them really providing comfort to kids.
And then there's Tiny the rat.
Right. That was, you know, there in the time I've lived here, there was a guy who had a chicken and he used to keep it on his head under a hat and then walk it around on a leash. And there was a young woman who had a rat that was so well trained, it did live in her sleeve, and she taught it to drink little juice out of little juice boxes with those tiny little straws.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was really a pet. And there's also was a rabbit for a long time that lived on the street. So people, you know, these animals provide some real comfort and companionship to kids.
Yeah. How much did you know about the story and the plot before you started to write? Are you a plotter? Do you need to really kind of spell it all out so you have something to follow, or how does that go for you?
I really took the incident that had happened and let this character take me through it. I did know that I didn't want to wrap things up easily, that I didn't think it was going to be a situation where things would be resolved and there would be redemption in the end and it would be wrapped up, because I don't think that's the way it happens for most people who are living out there. But I did let it, she went where she needed to go. So things would occur to me while I was writing and I would try something and it would not work. But it was interesting how much this character took on a life, and I felt like I was slipping into her mind, and the book just sort of went, the plot went where she took it. It was an interesting experience, and one I hadn't had before, even though I have actually written a couple other novels that are not what I'd call finished, but I never really had that experience before. Mm-hmm. So I did do a lot of development, you know, writing from her point of view, writing the kinds of letters she might have written to her mother, which I did not include in the book, and just really trying to get into her mind. But it was interesting how I didn't know it was going to happen.
Hmm. Did you have readers for the book as you went along for early drafts, or do you need to finish a draft before you show it to anybody?
I finished a draft before I showed it to anyone. However, I did read the beginning chapter. I did show the chapter at a workshop I was at, and then also read it aloud at a friend's house who was also head of, four of us were there, and we each read something really spontaneously that we were working on. And that was actually very helpful to get feedback about whether it made sense. And from then I waited until I had a draft. And then I showed a couple people. And I also, people have asked me, did I have some of the kids I talked to, did I have anyone read it? And I did not, although there were a couple young women who had lived in the park who were very generous and who I could speak to at length about their experience and who would let me know whether something was feasible. So a lot of the things in the book actually happened, but I didn't use anyone's story per se. Mm-hmm. It's all fiction, but I did check things with people as much as I could.
So I'm curious what the crossover was from journalism to fiction for you, because I would suspect that being a journalist, you as you said, you talked to kids in the park, you did research, but then there's the writing of fiction. And what's the crossover?
Well, I think there are a lot of techniques in narrative writing that can lead you to fiction. And I think that there were some similarities for me, but I do think as a journalist that I tend to do research to make sure that this is plausible and that is plausible. I had written fiction early on when I graduated from college, and I actually did half of a MFA program and then found myself at age 21 in a big public library, supposed to be part of a reading, and looking around and thinking, what am I doing? I don't know what I want to write about. So I segued into journalism and have had, a great experience doing that. But I always did think I'd go back to fiction. So along the way, I had been delving into it.
Do you prefer fiction then? Do you feel most at home in fiction?
I think that in a way, yes. But I also have things that I want to write about as a journalist and also as an essayist. I've really been writing some essays, and I think that I would continue to do both. And I can't get rid of my instinct, which was honed after being a journalist for so long, that I hear an ambulance and I want to run out on the street and find out what happened. And so, it's like my husband he just can't believe that I do that. I still, even though I'm not writing a story, something's happening in the neighborhood or, helicopter circling and I'm out there. Mm-hmm. So I can't help myself. I just want to know what's going on everywhere. So I think, that can help in fiction, but it also, you got to know when to turn it off, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. But, as you are talking about, the helicopter circling, I started wondering what, if there were novels that inspired you, or if there's a particular genre of fiction that you turn to.
I'd say that I'm most, I read a lot of fiction and contemporary fiction, going back and sort of just sitting with my old favorites. And I would say that I'm most formed, I was really, the part of me that's a storyteller was most formed by the Southern writers. And my family is very Southern. They on both sides came from Tennessee, and I spent a lot of time there as a child. And I really was always, what I was given to read was Faulkner and Flannery O'Connor and Eudora Welty and a lot of the Southerners. And I hear those voices in my head. So that, I think that had a really, really strong impact on me.
What did you read as a kid?
Well, you mean as a young kid?
Yeah.
Well, anything that I, pretty much anything I could find. I mean, I loved all of Wizard of Oz. And when I finally got around to reading that, I loved all of that. So I loved fantasy, not science fiction as much as just out there, stories that would, I would devour, to tell you the truth, anything that I could find. And I did spend a lot of time alone, like probably a lot of bookish kids. But I grew up in Los Angeles, and my parents were not helicopter parents. So they were, that sense that Maddie has of being alone in Los Angeles, it just, where you need a car to go anywhere. So I would just sort of be stuck there. I spent a lot of time in my room just reading, Nancy, anything I could get, Nancy Drew, Wizard mm-hmm. of Oz, Gone with the Wind, which I is so, now I look back on that particular book with such different eyes, having parents that come from the South and having just stayed up all night reading that book. Really, there's so much in it, of course, that I didn't see at the time. Hmm. But yeah, I was a real, I always hoped that I would get out of the house and have fun, but I was mostly in my room reading. Like, where is everyone that was cool and having a really good time? And I don't know where they are because I'm at home in my room.
Did you want to be a writer when you were a kid?
I did want to be a writer when I was a kid. And I did scribble things down and put them away. So I did sort of write things starting in elementary school. And then by the time I was in high school, I still was interested in writing, but in college, I was fortunate to have some amazing creative writing teachers. And there was no major in creative writing when I was an undergraduate. But I did think that that was what I wanted to do. I didn't know how it would happen. And I mm-hmm. did realize that I didn't at that age know what I wanted to write about. It took a long time until I was older and I'd had this career in journalism. And then I thought, I really know what I want to write about. And the publishing industry is completely imploded. So can I write about what I want to write about? So there was that.
Yeah. After I read the book, I started reading reviews and started just looking around for, things about you and how the book was categorized too. And somewhere, it might've been on Goodreads, I can't remember where, but somewhere your book was categorized as a YA novel. And I didn't see that as I was reading it. It had a very distinct voice of a 20-year-old or however old Maddie is,
yes,
a young 20. Woman. But I never felt that it was YA. And I was curious if you had read that anywhere and if you intended that, or if you, who you saw your readers as being.
I think that I didn't see it as being YA. And I my understanding is that there was a hope that it would be, there would be some crossover, but I didn't see it that way when I was writing it. And I think that I see the audience for it. I can't imagine kids in college reading it. It's I think it might be a little much for people in high school, although maybe not. And I think primarily people who like literary fiction, but who are interested in this issue of people being displaced. It's actually one that's always gotten to me. It's something I look across my writing, and I see that in the 1990s, I had gone to Sudan to write about the homeless kids living on the street of Khartoum, and spent a month doing that. Took a leave from my newspaper job to do that with a wonderful photographer, and I just think ever since then that I have it's something that's really intrigued me, and there are more people displaced around the world than there ever have been before. So whether it's, you know, what's happening in our country or whether it's famine and climate change. Mm-hmm. So I just think that's something that's always, the idea of being without roots, without a home is always something that is tied up very deeply in my thoughts. And it's interesting how, I don't know whether you've experienced this, but just how when you look back at a lot of things you've written, you see sort of similar themes. And mm-hmm. I was thinking, that's something I really have been so drawn to. So I think that there are people who might have seen what's going on in cities around the country who might wonder, well, you know, about the book.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was on your website and I saw some of your articles and had that sense that this has been an interest of yours for quite a while, and you were exploring it with journalism, narrative nonfiction. But it's interesting how those interests kind of find their way into whatever we're writing.
Yeah, definitely. They're just these themes mm-hmm. in our lives that for some reason just get to us. And, you know, it's a question of sort of writing about what you know and what you don't know. That's how I look at it. Because people have asked me, you know, well, how would you get into the mind of somebody who's homeless? Well, one, just talking to so many people to find out what's unknown to me, but also having grown up in a certain situation where I did know what it was like to be unseen. I had a home, but I did some of these longings and feelings and did, you know, of course they came from something I knew very well. Mm-hmm. So I was able to sort of hook into that.
Yeah. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Catherine Seligman. Her book is At the Edge of the Hate, published by Algonquin. And you received a wonderful award for this book, the Penn Bellwether Award. And I'm curious how that affected the book's publication. It came before or after?
The publication comes after. And mm-hmm. with this book, I had not, one of my early readers who himself has published many books said, it's difficult these days. Instead of starting out looking for an agent, why don't you you should submit to some contests and just see what happens. So I thought, okay, I'll do that. And that's really what happened. I submitted to two or three contests and was just astounded to hear from Barbara Kingsolver, mm-hmm. whose work I so admire. And the gift of it is that it comes with a publishing contract with Algonquin and a really wonderful, masterful editor there named Kathy Porries, who works with a lot of writers that are published by Algonquin, but also with the Bellwether winners. And it was great. It was a wonderful experience. And that was a huge gift to work with someone like that.
Yeah. So then, and then you got an agent?
Yeah. I after I won, then it was, of course, no problem to get an agent, because if you've already have a book deal, it's a lot easier to find an agent.
Yeah.
So yeah.
there's so many agents and still it's difficult.
Right. I know how difficult it is. And you know, particularly now, and particularly for people who've been shut out of the publishing process, and voices we have not heard from.
Yeah, what will happen with your other novels? Will we see any of them that were
I hope so. I'm going back to the to an earlier novel and realizing how much work I'm going to have to do on it. I still am attached to the premise in that novel enough to go back to it, but it needs a huge amount of a complete rewrite. So, but I feel like I've learned so much from what I've gone through in the past. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it was 2 years ago. They're just about to announce the next Bellwether winners. And I'd encourage anyone out there who is working on a book that deals with a social issue. And so many of us do write about mm-hmm. social issues. I mean, most of what I would say such incredible new fiction that I've been reading does deal with a social issue. And, you know, so I encourage people to apply for this, but to apply for contests for people who are for a debut novel, it's a good avenue to explore.
Yeah. You know, there are so many contests for novels and you know, poetry and short story collections. And I think, I don't know, I wonder if not more writers submit to those because they figure what are the chances, right? You know, it's like, but there's a chance. And so you never know, right?
There is a chance. And I think people should write the novel they intend to write. And if you can find contests that are looking for that sort of novel, then absolutely. There's no downside. And there are a number that give wonderful grants to continue work or mentors and or publication. Mm-hmm. So this is an incredibly generous, wonderful thing that Barbara Kingsolver does. So it's really a gift from that helps a writer go over a manuscript and find its way to publication.
Do you think writers should think at all about audience when they're writing a novel or a memoir or category or any of that or what? Or just, you know, just forget about readers, forget about everybody except what you're working on? And what do you think about that?
Well, it depends whether, you know, you have a day job and you have to sell the book. I would, you know, it's so idealistic to say, well, write the book you mean to write and it'll find a home. But that is somehow what I believe. That is actually what I believe. But if you write a book that works on some level, I think it speaks to an audience. And when you get to the point where you have to market it, then you have to know who that audience is. But I don't necessarily bring that into when I'm writing. When I was writing this book, I wasn't thinking who's the audience for this. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about this story that I felt like I had to tell and how did I want to tell it. And I do understand the marketing issues. It's just a different world than it used to be, where mm-hmm. they, particularly with nonfiction, with novels, I think maybe less so, but they want to know what shelf is this going to sit on? Mm-hmm. And I would have had no idea what shelf it sat on. I would say every shelf. Put it in the front of the bookstore in the window.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what do you tell your students about that?
Yeah, that's a tough one because, you know, I think lately what I've said and what I think is, especially if you're having trouble kind of, I don't know, getting a hold of what you're trying to do is to think about one reader, you know, who's the one reader you might see reading this. And as far as categories, I mean, different genres have different conventions. And, you know, if you're writing a mystery, you know, if you're writing a cozy, how does that go? And, you know, if you're writing literary fiction, though, which is what I consider this, then it seems that it's kind of open-ended, right? I mean, you want...
It does, yes.
Yeah. You want the writing, you want something to happen, but it may be a bit more about the language and the execution of the story than plot. I don't know, but see, what I like about this is that it has both. Your book has attention to the writing, and it has the plot, and it has suspense that goes through from the very first chapter when this event happens in the park. I think for me that is most appealing as a reader.
Well, yeah, there has to be some thread that carries the reader through. And it doesn't have to be conventional, but this, you know, mine is storytelling is fairly conventional in that I didn't, you know, play wildly with form or with time or with, and I've read, you know, some books that do that. And that sort of wouldn't be me, at least right now. But I think if you're as a writer, if you're taken somewhere that you know, in your mind, if you're drawn to experiment with something, that's what you should be doing. Mm-hmm. For me, the what was most important to me was that this character be believable. I mean, it is fiction, and you come here and you won't see these people or really where they sleep, but you might see kids who look like them, but I just really wanted to make her voice this character believable. And that took many drafts to do that, but that was something that was very much in my mind. Would people read this and believe it?
Mm. Yeah, I think so. I believed it. Maddie takes a photography class later on in the book, and there's a mention of a book of photos of people with their belongings. And as I was reading that, I thought, I used to have that book. Yeah. And I wondered if you were talking about Peter Menzel's Material World, the global yes. family portrait. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Well, he was, yeah. And there've been other people, but he was somebody who really did that. But there have been a number of people, and there've been a number of student projects and things where people did that, like little experimental projects. I wanted to make it local enough so that, you know, yeah, I wasn't taking someone's work and, you know, making it into something else. But yeah, that has definitely been done and made a real impression on me. And I have looked at a lot of photography. You can probably tell from that mm-hmm, I've mm-hmm. thought a lot about photography and thought a lot about it. And my husband has done a lot of photography and published books. So he has taught me a lot about photography. And so I'm just interested in the notion of the relationship of the person who's taking the picture to what they're the picture. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that I something I always think of. So I got lost in that a little bit in the book.
Mm. Yeah, it was nice. It was good. You know, we haven't really talked about the side characters of Ash, Fleet, and Hope. Maybe say a few words about them and kind of how they found their way into the book.
Well, I wanted to create this world that I had sort of seen on the street of kids who are able to assemble little families around them. And I see a lot of affection among them. And so I had, you know, I chose these characters just sort of based on what Maddie needed to have in her life. I realized there would be a man who sort of was a romantic interest, but who couldn't really get to know her very well because she's in some way unknowable. She just really fought against having him being really truly intimate with him, because it's something she just finds she can't do. The more I talk to kids and saw kids, and I just think these characters, they just sort of came to me, and they do actually have street names that they pretty much use exclusively with each other. And it's, so that, you know, that really intrigued me. I followed one case that was fairly well known in the neighborhood, where there'd been a group of young people who formed a sort of family and had been involved in this sort of vigilante justice against this one guy who was on the outside, and they ended up beating him to death over a couple weeks, and he fell in this man-made lake at the end of Haight Street and died. And I dug into all their court records, and I was looking at their, I was really surprised that all of the court records used their street names too. And I just thought that was so deeply embedded in their identities. I wanted to actually go to jail and interview them, but their lawyers wouldn't allow me to. But I did just sort of was imagining what life would be like, and knowing that they had these very vibrant relationships where they really depended on each other, and sometimes terrible things happened. And you often would find women who attached themselves to men because they would feel taken care of, as one of the characters, Hope, is constantly referring to people that she meets on the street as, she'll have a husband, he's my husband. And at one point, Maddie refers to Ash as her husband. So I think there's a lot of sort of doing that for safety. Of course, the kids stay together for safety, but also to have these human relationships that seem very real. And I've seen that happen, particularly post-pandemic, when there were a lot of tent encampments right in the neighborhood, and would see how people really looked out for each other. And also there was a lot of violence, but and you'd see small groups where people really looked out for each other, called each other family.
We have a few minutes left, and we can't end without acknowledging that the world is in the middle of a pandemic, and a lot of what we did more than a year ago has really kind of changed. And so I'm curious how it's going for you writing wise.
Well, it's in the beginning, it was just so hard to concentrate on anything. And even though I was inside and basic introvert and should have been able to just sit in a closed room all the time, I found I still, there was one of my kids was living here, and a huge, with her huge dog. And it was just, there was a lot going on. It was hard to concentrate. And I really found it very difficult. And I've gone back to being able to read a lot. And I have gone back to being able to work. But I had a shared office space in a wonderful group called the Writer's Grotto. And it's a really wonderful community of writers in every discipline. And some people share an office, some people are just part of the larger community and don't actually physically work there. But we lost the building where we were working because we couldn't use it, so we had to give it up. There was no point in paying rent. So that was a big loss to me, just the idea of this community. You could go in a tiny little room and sit down at your desk, but you knew all throughout the other offices on the floor that other people were in there and they were going through the same things. And when you got up to get tea in the kitchen, there'd be three or four people in there. And it still remains a very supportive community, but I miss that, having the physical space where I could go. So yeah, it's been hard. And also as I said, I think earlier, we had a fairly large tent encampment right on the street where I live. And it was on both sides of the street and it was very loud. And I got very distracted by it because you could just, we were right in their living room and they were in our living room. And so that was tremendously distracting, both because it was really noisy and distressing, but also because I would just get involved in people's, way too involved in what was going on out there. And at one point, forcing my husband to go out, he used to be an emergency room doctor. And so going down and saying, you know, you have to help this guy because he's got this huge cut on his head, you know, so things like that. Mm-hmm. We'd be down there and he'd be, you know, putting special tape on the guy's head. And so I got way too involved in what was going on out there and very, very distracted. Those people have now moved to what's called a safe sleep site. In the neighborhood, which is a little tent village, which is has stabilized a lot of people and really been a good thing. So it's quieter.
Will the grotto start up again as a physical space when this is over?
You know, I don't know. We hope so. There are those of us who hope so. And there's so little alternative for writers where you can find inexpensive space to write. And although almost all of us have homes where we can write, some people don't. It's too, their living spaces are too cramped, or they live with other people and they just can't get the kind of solitude they need. But I just feel that it's essential to have that. And I'm really hoping that they will find another space.
Oh dear. I mean, this hour has flown by, Catherine. Do you have any last words or words of advice for the writers listening?
Well, I would say that which you know if you're a writer, but that if it's really important to persevere and to, I think it helps to have a community that reminds you of that. And when we think about giving up, I've just seen myself and the people in this community so often say, I just can't do this any longer. Why am I doing this? I think it helps to realize just how hard it is and to remember why we do what we do. It's, you know, it's not easy to get things published right now. So I think don't lose sight of the story you're telling and why you're telling it.
Yeah. Community helps with that so much. Just other people, you know, knowing that there are other writers also working and that you're connected with them. It helps keep us all going, doesn't it?
It does. I think that's really an important thing. So find that, you know, the supportive writing group or organization that will help you with that.
Catherine Seligman, thank you so much. And thank you for At the Edge of the Hate. It was a wonderful read.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really my pleasure.
You're welcome. And I hope you out there, all you listeners out there, check out the book. It really is wonderful. We're at the end of our time. Thank you for listening. You can find past shows on iTunes. Look up Writers on Writing. Subscribe, and when we podcast this show and all the others, they fall in your podcast file. So please do that. It'll help others find the podcast as well. In any case, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we'll be here next Wednesday at 9 a.m. Thank you so much for listening.
to pretend that we brought separate air mattresses. My walls are full of watercolors you painted for me. Of all the things that I'm scared of, you scare me. Share the same bed. I'll buy you flowers and we'll take pictures of them when they're dead. And we'll live while this world crashes down. Oh, we'll live. So let's throw all our shit in the lake. 5 billion years, but the last 100 were a mistake. When are we moving on? I hear Mars looks great in the spring. Save us all, Elon. Our souls can thaw while we freeze. But we'll live while this world crashes down. This world crashes down.